Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Weiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to The Middle Ground. This is Michael Charney. I hope to be joined tonight by co-host Eric Weiler, who is again on the road. He's in North Carolina doing some filming for the Story of America series he's doing with Annabelle Park. Hopefully, he will have a chance to call in and join us as well. But even if it's just me, I know we have a very interesting show tonight. We're taking the show in a slightly different direction this evening. Today, as some of you may be aware, is World Autism Awareness Day. And by the way, I should apologize. The notices that went out indicated that today was National Autism Awareness Day. In fact, it's World Autism Awareness Day. Autism is a worldwide issue, not simply a national one. April is Autism Awareness Month. There have been a number of promotions and specials and publicity around it. One organization, Autism Speaks, which you'll hear a little bit more about later in the show, has been urging people to replace one of the light bulbs in front of their homes or somewhere where it's visible with a blue light bulb, blue being the color that symbolizes autism. And when I awoke this morning, I thought about it being Worldwide Autism Awareness Day. I hadn't really planned on what we were going to do on the show tonight. And I thought, you know, this is interesting that we, in our conversations about public policy and about government and about money and where it's spent, one of the issues that seems to stay under the rug quite a bit is our public health issues. We hear about them, generally speaking, in moments of crisis. We don't hear about them on an ongoing basis very often. We hear in general about healthcare and healthcare costs, but specific issues, when they show up in the news, tend to be about things that have happened suddenly. For example, an E. coli outbreak or a salmonella outbreak or, you know, bird flu or the H1N1 virus. These things that, frankly, are something that, in my opinion, are scary enough to interest the media and are the kinds of things that kind of freak people out. And, I mean, to this day, I will still sometimes travel and see people wearing masks, particularly if I travel internationally, to try to protect themselves. And, you know, everywhere you go, you can, you know, they have those little hand sanitizer dispensers so you can keep your hands clean and make sure that you're totally germ-free. I know when I go to the supermarket, and I do a fair bit of the food shopping in my family, you can get a little disinfectant wipes so that you can wipe off the handles of the shopping cart, the bar that goes across the shopping cart, because, you know, you don't know who might have touched it before you. And we've created sort of this fear around sudden events. But there are a number of public health issues that become an increasing concern over time in a very slow and steady and in my mind an equally scary way, but because they're not driven by some event or some disaster or some outbreak or some crisis, we don't hear much about them. And autism, to me, is one of those issues. And I thought I would take advantage of the fact that we don't often talk about public health on this show to raise that issue and hopefully bring some awareness around not only autism, but in general, the idea that our public health network seems not to be oriented very much around long-term things, with the possible exception of obesity, I think, as a chronic health issue. We often don't hear about things unless they're sudden and sort of earth-shaking. The fact is that autism is slow and methodically earth-shaking, if that's not a strange word to use. In this case, I dug up some statistics in preparation for tonight's show, and also called someone I know, a guest, I'm going to bring her on in a few minutes, a woman named Carrie Cariello, who's written a wonderful memoir called What Color is Monday? How Autism Changed One Family for the Better, recently published, and doing quite well, I understand. So we're going to be talking with her about her personal experiences. We thought we would personalize this issue and give you some sense of what a family goes through when they're faced with autism. But first, just some sense of the scale of what we're talking about. Back in 2009, we had, in the United States, 1.5 million people were diagnosed with autism. And to be a little bit more specific, we're talking about something called ASD, or Autism Spectrum Disorder, which covers the range from very, very severe autism through to highly functioning individuals, perhaps with Asperger's disease. And it rather than specifying that a person has a specific set of symptoms, in fact, the autism spectrum covers a range of symptoms, some or all of which may be present in various people along the spectrum. And that actually has public policy implications, which I'll talk about in a moment. But in 2009, we had about 1.5 million people diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. And at that time, President Bush signed a bill which authorized $945 million for research, treatment, and services. And that represented, at the time, a 50% increase over the previous allocations for this condition, for this spectrum disorder. Just shy of $1 billion in government budget terms is not an enormous amount of money. I don't know, for example, how it would, what the numbers would be for something like cancer, but I'm sure they'd be quite a bit higher. But still, it was a sizable chunk of money, and President Bush signed that into law in December 2009. At that time, roughly 1 in 166 children were being diagnosed with autism, and that covers anyone diagnosed from very early infancy up through age 18, 1 in 166. Here we are now, just over 3 years later, and the number is now 1 in 88. So basically double the number of people are being diagnosed with autism than they were 3 years ago. And at the same time, the amount of funding for federal funding, I should stress this is federal funding, for research, treatment, and services has dropped significantly. So at the end of 2011, middle of 2011, President Obama reauthorized the expenditure for research, treatment, and services for autism spectrum disorder, but the amount was down to $693 million, which is about a 25% cut. Now, of course, lots of things were cut, and it's understandable between 2009 and the time that Obama reauthorized the program. The economy crashed, and there were many cuts in lots of places, particularly lots of social programs. There were constant fights as well. Another interesting thing is that in 2009, when Congress passed the bill that President Bush signed, it was passed on a voice vote, which means that there was, fundamentally no significant argument against the expenditure. I would have a difficult time imagining today that that such expenditures wouldn't somehow stall in Congress, but that's a topic for another show. It's a topic for many of our shows, the inability of Congress to function properly. But in the grand scheme of things, we have a public health problem that has doubled in scope in 3 years, and yet we've seen federal funding drop quite a bit. Most of the services and treatment programs that go on, in fact, are handled more at the state and local levels, particularly in schools. We'll talk a little bit with Carrie about what kinds of programs her son Jack participates in that that are funded through special programs. To give you a little bit of a sense, in my own state, and Carrie's state, in fact, in New Hampshire actually keeps an autism registry, and this was passed legislatively. They're one of only two states in the country, at least as of the end of 2012, one of only two states in the country that actually kept a registry and was keeping very detailed statistics on the number of diagnoses for autism spectrum disorder. And in an effort to begin to track, hopefully, some of the causes, the prevalence of it, demographic data, things of that nature. And so New Hampshire has some pretty good statistics about what's going on in its state. I looked up the last 2 years for which there are data from New Hampshire. In the and they track from the July to June, the fiscal year time frame. In the 2010 to 2011 period, there were 107 diagnoses of autism spectrum disorder in New Hampshire. Understanding, to put that in a little bit of perspective, that's in a state with roughly 1.2 million of total population, of which less than a third is under age 18. So we had 107 in my state. In the following year, the period from middle of 2011 until the middle of 2012, that number had jumped to 157 for that 12-month period. That's a 47% increase in 1 year. Now, the relative numbers are small, so it's hard to say how much of that is going to be consistently increasing over time. But still, that's a bit of a scary number. 76% of that number were children who were diagnosed under the age of nine. So it is growing there as well. One of the interesting things from a public policy perspective on autism now is has to do with how it's defined. And this is an issue, again, very few are really talking about or are noticing, but for those of you who are familiar at all with any kind of mental services or mental health issues, you may be aware that there's something called the DSM. It's the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual that put out by the American Psychological Association. And over the past couple of years, every few years they issue a new version. Currently, the current version is DSM-4, and we're just short of releasing. Or they're just short of releasing the fifth version, DSM-5. And one of the issues that's been raised is that in DSM-5, it looks like they will be changing the definition of autism slightly. And there may be people who are currently on the spectrum, particularly people with Asperger's, higher functioning people on the spectrum, who will potentially no longer be considered autistic. And I always find it interesting when a government can just, well, in this case, it's an association, not the government, but it will affect how government allocates its money. When an organization that has a public policy responsibility or a public policy impact simply changes the definition, and it can affect, in this case, tens of thousands of people. We're looking at potentially significant amounts of money that are being allocated to people on the spectrum that will perhaps not be available to some people in the future who have been dependent on it in the past. And as we'll talk with Carrie in a few minutes, her son Jack is reasonably high functioning in many ways. Children like Jack and others may be affected by some of these changes. In Indiana, for example, Indiana spends $102 million a year, some of it obviously from federal funding, but some of it from state sources, and they're looking at potentially a large number of people who would no longer be eligible for a number of these services once the definition changes. Indiana, by the way, has noticed that in the last decade, their number of diagnosed spectrum disorder cases has tripled in 10 years. As one person said in an article that I wrote, the label brings money to the schools, and the schools are a fundamental piece of of the services that are provided in these cases. So if you think about not only autism but other kinds of mental health issues, these kinds of public policy issues are can be critical to individual people and the lives that they lead. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. As always, it's a call-in show, and I'm particularly interested if anyone has been touched by autism or has any thoughts in general on the implications of public policy changes to funding and to people's lives. Please, as always, you're welcome to call into the show. We encourage you to call into the show. We are at area code 646-929-2495. That's 646-929-2495 to call in and join the show. You can listen, as always, on the Internet as well. If you call in and you'd like to join the show, please press 1. That way you'll pop to the top of the queue, and I'll know you're interested in speaking with us, and I'll bring you on. But for right now, what I'd like to do is have our guest join us on the show. Terry Cariello is a mother of 5 young children. She and her husband, Joe, live in Bedford, New Hampshire. And a moment of full disclosure and full transparency, since I think that's always important to our program. For those of you who may not know, those of us in the Coffee Party volunteer our time, and we all have day jobs of some kind. And one of mine is that I am what's known as a micro-publisher. I own a small publishing company, Riddlebrook Publishing. And just a little over a year ago, I put out an advertisement for submissions. And the mission of Riddlebrook Publishing is to support beginning writers, particularly in New England. And we publish essentially narrative nonfiction, memoirs, and related kinds of books for what we call the New England writer. And our mission is to not only publish New England writers and give them a chance, but to foster New England publishing business. So all of the services that we use, our editing services, our design services, our proofreading services, all of it is from freelancers in the New England area. And so that mission has led us to sort of focus on this. Carrie submitted several essays that were starting to become something like a book, and had this idea for how she wanted to put it together. And I was so taken with her prose and her story that I agreed to publish the book and signed Carrie about a year ago. We've been working on it together for quite some time. Carrie and I did not know each other before that. It's coincidental that we happen to live just a few miles apart. But I just, in fairness, as we talk about the book, I want everyone to know that I did have, I was involved in the book. I do know something about it. And if you do go out and choose to buy the book, that would be great. Carrie obviously will appreciate that. And also, the book has a donation component as well. A percentage of the profits are going to Autism Speaks, which we'll talk about as well in a little bit. So welcome, Carrie Cariello, to the Middle Ground. Thank you for joining me on very short notice. I appreciate it. How are you this evening?
I am good. Can you hear me? Am I here?
You are here, and we can hear
you.
Oh,
good.
Thank you very much.
Great.
We have occasionally had technical problems with the board, but you'll know sooner than I will if there's an issue.
Okay.
So... I'd like to start with, as I mentioned early on in my monologue here, I think what's interesting is to hear a personal story from somebody who goes through it. I think many, many people have been touched by autism, but there's something unique about hearing from somebody who's lived it. And so I want to start with the title.
Mm.
And again, obviously, I know where the title comes from, but I think our audience would be interested. The title of the book, again, What Color is Monday? Tell us what that means, and maybe tell us a little bit about your family and Jack and where that came from.
Sure. So we have 5 kiddos, 4 boys and 1 girl, and they range in age right now from 10 until 4. 10, Jack's going to be 9. We have one who's 7. Our daughter's 5, and then the youngest is 4. One day, about a year ago, year and a half ago now, Jack asked me during the dinner hour what color I see for Monday, and he speaks in very clipped tones, and he said, Mom, what color is Monday? And I was confused, and I was caught up in a lot of other tasks at the time, and I just couldn't really focus, and then eventually I said, I don't know what you mean, Jack. I don't see the days of the week as color. And then he went on to explain in his abbreviated prose that he does see that every day of the week is a different color for him. So that was an interesting conversation, and I just kind of tucked it away. And then later on that winter, you and I started to work on the book and pull the essays together and kind of make things fit and flow. And I remember talking to you about the title, and really, as I worked, struggling to find a good title that would fit the pieces and sort of tell the story. I played with a lot of different concepts, you know, life with autism, enjoying autism. For the longest time, I thought about doing something with snowflakes in the title, because I think that image comes to mind a lot for me when I think of autism and Jack. Snowflakes, something drifting and different and fragile and beautiful. And then just one day I was driving in the car with them, and I thought back on that conversation on what color is Monday, and that's kind of where it came from. Before that, I thought about doing something like Thursday is purple, and I mentioned that to Jack, and he said that Thursday is sometimes green and sometimes it's blue, so I decided better not make it too definitive.
Right, and of course we're not going to ask you to tell us what color Monday
It's a big reveal at the end.
It's a big reveal at the end of the book, of course. So tell us a little bit about how did you come to the realization that you thought Jack might be autistic? What was that like? And in particular, what kind of services, who did you go to? How did you come to figure all that out? Who helped you in the public sector?
Sure. So we were living in Buffalo, New York at the time, and Jack was born just a year after our first son, 13 months. And our experience, right from the get-go, he was a little unusual. He wasn't as engaged as a baby. He never pointed. He never really made a lot of noise or babbled or cooed. I tell a story about one time we were in a restaurant when he was 6 months old and sitting in a high chair. And it's a very poignant memory for me, and I go into it in further detail in the book. Because it's the last time I remember not worrying about Jack and thinking something is just not right here, and not feeling in my gut, in my bones, that something was off with this child. And so he was 6 months old. So from that point forward, I just felt in my soul that he was not connecting with us or with the world in a way that was appropriate for his age.
Now, I assume people around you probably told you you were being silly and, you know, let it go and he'll develop at his own pace. How did you know that they were wrong and you were right?
Well, it was a bit of a battle because, family always likes to sort of, people want to smooth things over, and their intentions are always great. And we heard a lot of, Joey's talking for him. Joey's our first son, a year older. Everybody develops at their own rate. And that is very true, and I do believe that. Everybody does develop at their own rate. For me, it was just a mother's instinct. It was something I couldn't put aside. I couldn't ignore. It nagged at me constantly. I remember he didn't sleep well at all. And some of the only things that would soothe him were those Baby Einstein movies. I'm sure they're still out, but they were really popular then. And we would get up in the middle of the night with him. I remember sitting on this sectional that we had. We had like a tan microfiber sectional. And sitting with Joe, just putting those movies in, and I said to Joe, you know something's wrong. Something is not right with him. Something is not right here. And
So we should be clear. Joe is your husband as opposed
Joe
to Joe
is the husband. Joe
oldest,
is my husband.
Right.
Still my husband, yeah. After all.
Still his husband.
And we got rid of that microfiber couch because I hated it. But it's a really clear memory to me. And it was in the face of a lot of people telling me to let it go. So I think by about 8 or 9 months, we were referred to early intervention services for evaluations. And by that point, it was pretty clear.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Early intervention services.
Early intervention. They started to evaluate.
Is state funded, or these are programs that are available? Or
I think it's state funded. Yeah, it was through New York State, and they just started evaluating them. And the hardest part now, back then, so we're coming up on 9 years ago, 8 years ago. This was all starting to explode. So I feel like at that time, autism was starting to really take shape for people and move forward, like you cited those statistics before in the show, it was started to grow and people started to say, wow, there's more of this than there ever was. I think we hit our stride at the same time. So we started to schedule these evaluations, and I remember one of the hardest things, you'd call all these offices and say, I have a son, and he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, and I'm nervous. And they'd say, okay, well, we'll see. The next opening we have is 5 months away. And Joe and I would look at each other and say, well, we thought he'd outgrow this by then. We thought we'd be over this, and we would have overcome this hurdle, and he'd be sort of the bright, happy, normal boy we pictured him to be. So that waiting period was really difficult. And every day felt like a day lost because we knew we needed more help than we could give him.
Right. So I guess back then funding, I'm sure, was quite a bit lower. So it was a struggle for you to find the kinds of services you needed, even just to get diagnosed properly?
Yes, just to get diagnosed properly probably in retrospect, not super long, but a little longer than two parents who are in the midst of this would have liked.
Right. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
So I'm curious because at about that time, I may have my dates a little bit off, but it seems to me at around that time there was a lot of noise. And I think it's Jenny McCarthy was the one who was doing a lot, who was on TV a lot. This big push around, vaccines were the problem and you should stop vaccinating your children. Did you ever look at that or any kinds of similar, kind of hot button issues? What were the, I imagine you must have been desperate to try to figure out what the cause was, right?
Our experience was a little different than hers and people that cite vaccines as the cause because, Jack, typically, as I understand it, people that look to vaccines are because their child was developing pretty normally until around age 2 or 3, where those and it coincides with the times those vaccinations are given. So Jack sort of came out who he was. He came out with autism, I firmly believe. So it just was not our experience. But yes, that was a very hot topic then. I think it still kind of continues to be today. Her son, I think, is about the same age as Jack. So we sort of followed the same journey for a while.
Did you get pressure from people on that issue, or were people around you telling you this is why or that's why and you should do this?
People asked me, are you going to vaccinate him? And I thought, well, yeah, it never really occurred to me not to. We always followed the advice of the developmental pediatrician and then our regular pediatrician and all the professionals we had involved. And nobody once counseled us to avoid vaccinations for him. So it definitely came up for sure, just like these days, gluten-free comes up a lot, casein-free comes up a lot as a discussion point for us. And there's a million different strategies you could take to sort of quote-unquote fix him or improve him or do what's best for him. And his parents were always trying to sift through the latest data and research, and there's just so much out there.
So it's funny that you bring up the fixing because the opening chapter, and we're going to do something a little different. I'm actually going to ask you to read a couple of short passages so people can get a feel for your prose and what you went through. The book opens with essentially this letter that you wrote to yourself about what you wish you had known at the time, this idea of you mentioned fixing. I think in the book you refer to somebody who wants to save their son. Can you perhaps read just a short piece from that for us to give people a feel from what you wish you had known, what you wish people had told you at the time?
Sure. Let me.
I'm catching Carrie a little off guard. I did tell her to keep
that's
the book
okay.
Hand, but
I will. I'm going to start at the beginning of that letter, Michael, and you just clear your throat when you think you've heard enough. How's that? Is that a good cue? Clear it loudly. Okay. So yes, the letter is dated the day that 2-year-old Jack was diagnosed by the developmental pediatrician back in Buffalo. So it's November 3rd, 2006, and it starts, "Dear Self, today you received Jack's official diagnosis. You expected this news all along, but you're still reeling from the doctor's softly spoken words. You listened attentively to his hushed voice saying things like considerable delay and early intervention as Jack whirled and spun around the tiny exam room. At one point, you started to sweat. It's been a long journey leading up to this day, a long road of when will he talk and why doesn't he recognize me? A long 2 years of tantrums, heartache, and the eerie quiet of a toddler who doesn't speak. Months of watching your brown-haired boy through a two-way mirror as a variety of specialists tested his hearing, tested his language, tested the way he stacked multicolored blocks. Autism. Right now you're thinking you can fix him, that he will outgrow this, but you can't and he won't. Instead, both you and he will learn to coexist with it, and in the process you'll discover how grateful you are to be privy to the miracle of his mind. Slowly, steadily, you're going to see Jack for everything he is rather than what he is not. The list of he's not talking, when will he point, why doesn't he play with the others, will eventually be replaced with look at his smile, I love to hear his voice, tell me again, Jack, tell me everything you have to say, tell me. He will surprise you every single day.
That's great. So how does he surprise you? You know, the subtitle of your book, How Autism Changed One Family for the Better. How did that happen? What is better about having, I don't want to say about having Jack. Obviously, he's your son. It's a wonderful thing. You never don't want to have your own child. But what is it that actually has made your family better?
Well, he does surprise me every single day. Just the other day, and anyone who's listening right now who has a child on the spectrum can appreciate this, he had taken my phone. He likes to tool around on my phone, and it drives me crazy. And I said, please bring me that phone. And he brought me the phone, and he said, I'm sorry I took so long. And that was huge. That was a huge shift for him to understand I was waiting and to actually be able to anticipate what my opinion, what my mood, what my thought would be about waiting for this phone. So every day I get to see these little leaps in progress that mean he's evolving. He's starting to see the world, I don't want to say more normally because I would never say that for him, but he's starting to really learn about the way people feel and how others think, because being flexible is probably one of Jack's biggest obstacles, having cognitive flexibility and realizing other people think and feel differently than he does, right? So things like that just surprise me, as I said in the book, every single day I'm surprised by that. How has he made us better? I mean, I just had this conversation with somebody a few days ago, and I kind of thought and parsed it down. You know what he does? He brings out the best in us every single day. And he does that in a variety of ways. He brings out the best in his siblings. He forces Joe and I to stretch and bend and grow for him in ways we never thought were possible, and just kind of transformed us as parents. And he really forces me to be very mindful of how I parent, mindful of how I communicate. And that's kind of transcended the way I communicate with not only my own children, but everybody in the world around me.
Yeah, I think the phrase you use in the book, if I recall, actually, I'm being disingenuous. I worked on your book quite a bit, and I read it 13 times.
So
I have to say,
you know it better than I do.
I don't think I know better than you do. But one of the phrases you use in the book is low and slow as the way to talk to Jack, and you contrast that with saying it was difficult for you because your natural model is high and fast. It must be a bit chaotic having, it's a family of seven. You have five kids. Your oldest, Billy, is 9 going on 10, I believe, right?
He just turned 10. I can't
just
believe it.
Just turned 10.
So I've been a mother for a decade.
Kids between the ages of 4 and 10.
Yeah.
How do you make time for Jack's needs, and how do the other kids deal with him?
Well, I think that's the beauty of it, and I understand a lot of parents who have a spectrum child are reluctant, hesitant to move forward and have more children, and I completely understand and respect that. For us, the kids came very quickly. Some came without notice, if you will, and just sort of before we knew it, we had this family of five kids. So we never spent a lot of time reflecting, well, maybe we shouldn't go forward with another, or what if another one is born with Jack's issues or worse, or how much will that add to our workload? In retrospect, it was the best thing we ever did to give Jack a large family. They, you know, push him further while at the same time they wait for him. They embrace him for exactly who he is. It's his own little social group within our house. And I think, you know, to manage the chaos that can happen with five kids and does happen, I was listening to it while you had me on mute unfold upstairs as Joe's ushering them all to bed. Jack has got to be one of that group. We cannot single him out. We cannot let him have a different bedtime or eat a different meal or behave any differently in a restaurant than we let the others do. So he's really sort of held to the same standards in our family of behavior that they all are. And in our opinion, that's benefited him greatly.
In a sense, you've mainstreamed him as a child, right? I imagine there are times where you have to do things for Jack, or you have to change what you might otherwise do for Jack. But in general, you've just mainstreamed him into your family. You try to treat him as normally as possible.
You know, that's exactly it. And there are times we flex for him because, and I'll explain. So at this point, only Joey, 10-year-old, and Charlie, 7-year-old, are aware that Jack is special needs and has autism. I believe Rose and maybe Henry, he's only 4, but definitely Rose, 5 years old, I believe on some level she knows because she's very careful with him. She's very gentle with him. And they speak to him differently. They know that if they want to get a point across to Jack, you can't go off on some, you know, tangent or dialogue and overwhelm him. So we do ask them to flex every now and again. You know, Jack asked, this was funny, a few weeks ago he wanted to host what he called the Easter party. So what he meant was he wanted Easter dinner here. And normally my mother-in-law does that, and that's sort of been our family tradition. But when Jack asks for something like that, we make that happen because he's moving forward. He's demonstrating some gains and some progress by asking for a social situation to happen in his house. You know, if Jack asks to go to a certain restaurant, a lot of times we go to that restaurant. So the kids have learned to kind of flex when autism takes the forefront. They've learned that sometimes, unfortunately, autism brings chaos to a family in the form of a tantrum that could happen in public or, you know, maybe a nighttime routine that doesn't go so well in this house, something like that. So I think we've all made room for it as best we can.
Very interesting. Part of what I'm hearing, too, is this idea that your kids are actually becoming, your other 4 children are becoming better communicators because they're learning to adapt communication styles, and that very likely will serve them more effectively in the future as they meet lots of different people with lots of different styles and opinions and ways of doing things. I want to get back in a minute to bring us back into the public sector. First, just before I go to a very quick break, can you tell us a little bit about Jack's functional level? I know they don't actually place people in specific places on the spectrum. They don't say like he's, you know, 21% autistic or, you know, closer to Asperger's or whatever. But in terms of what you know about the autism spectrum, Jack sounds like he's reasonably high functioning. In school, is he mainstream, for example, or he's obviously grown a lot, but kind of where he, in your mind, where is he on that degree of functionality level?
I would describe him as fairly high functioning. He is mainstream in a regular third grade classroom. He has a full-time paraprofessional or aide, sometimes they refer to them. You know, people ask me that a lot, and it's a hard question for me to answer. Knowing the range that's out there in terms of the range of verbal children versus nonverbal, children with a whole sort of host of issues. Jack is very high functioning in terms of verbal communication. He can verbally request what he needs and what he wants. And then there's other elements that he really works hard to master, socially connecting with the people around him. Is very difficult. He struggles quite a bit with a high level of anxiety, which we learned over the past few years we didn't realize this, it goes hand in hand with autism. So, and he's rigid. He's rigid in not so much in terms of the bath always has to happen at 7:10 or, you know, all you know what breaks loose. He's rigid in terms of he can't consider that other people have ideas that are different than his own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surprising how much that gets in his way at times.
Okay. Well, so, we're going to come back in just about 1 minute. I want to talk with Carrie some more, particularly about the kinds of services that Jack gets in school. We'll see from a personal level how the funding that supports research and treatment for autism affects one individual family. But first, let me just remind everybody, you're listening to The Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network. If you'd like to join the show, our number here is 646-929-2495, and feel free to press 1 and you can join the show. We also have a chat room going for anybody who on our call page, anybody would like to join the chat, you're welcome to do that as well. I want to take a minute and talk a little bit about the Coffee Party and one of the major programs that we're running in 2013. Let everybody know about something called the 535 Campaign. The 535 Campaign is the number one initiative the Coffee Party is running this year. As many of you know, the Coffee Party's main interest has always been the effect of money in politics and the way that money and special interests affect public policy and down to the very, very specific levels of individual families and social services and social needs, as well as larger issues like foreign policy and healthcare. For example, the 535 campaign is the Coffee Party's program to find out from each of the 535 members of Congress, the 435 House members and the 100 senators, what their position is on money in politics, and particularly if they have any plans or intentions on promoting the overturn of Citizens United versus FEC, which the Federal Election Commission, which was the case just over 3 years ago, which basically opened the floodgates to what we now call as super PACs and created what we refer to as dark money in politics. And as most of you know, ballooned the amount of money that was spent on campaigns over the last year, particularly the presidential campaign, where nearly $1 billion was spent. The 535 campaign is a volunteer-driven program where we're trying to find people across the country who are interested in communicating directly with their representatives or senators, and we will be posting on our Coffee Party web pages on Nation Builder the responses that we get, and we will begin to track the positions that our representatives, our elected representatives, the people who are there to represent us, their positions on money and politics. It's all part of an overall effort and a grand theme of the Coffee Party to return as much as we possibly can to a place where the largest single voice in the political process belongs to us and not large money special interests. So if you have a moment, please go to our website, www.coffeeparty.com, coffeepartyusa.com, sorry, and take a look at our 535 campaign. In addition, I'd like to remind everybody that the Coffee Party is a grassroots organization driven by small donations from people like you. So while you're over there taking a look at that campaign, if you would be so kind as to click on the donate button and offer $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever you can afford to help the Coffee Party in its mission, that would be very welcome. We're here again tonight talking about autism as it affects one family, as a way of thinking about the effects of public policy and public health on a number of issues in our society, ones that don't necessarily get the attention that they deserve. It is my hope that something like Worldwide Autism Awareness Day would no longer be necessary, because it would be an issue that would be driven on a year-round basis by regular need and regular concern. Our guest tonight is Carrie Cariello, author of the book What Color is Monday? How Autism Changed One Family for the Better. Again, our number is 646-929-2495 if you'd like to call in and join the show. We do have a caller in queue I'm going to bring in just a moment here, but I want to ask you first, mm-hmm. If you could tell us a little bit about the services, the special services that are available to Jack, and in particular, where we live, there's a program called BEEP, which is, I guess, we live in Bedford, so it's the Bedford something educational program, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it is a service that the state provides. And you mentioned just before I went to break that that there's a paraprofessional, an aide, and that person, I guess, is devoted to Jack, right? In addition to he spends a chunk of time, I guess, in a regular classroom and a chunk of time in other special programs. What are the services that you depend on that are funded by state or federal money?
So through the school, he has the paraprofessional, and he gets speech several times a week and then occupational therapy several times a week. He has access to an integration room if there's a time during the day where he can't really calm his body or is feeling out of sorts and needs a break from the regular classroom. He can go there. And we
the school actually has a facility for special needs kids if they need to separate themselves. So
yes.
There's costs associated with that as well, right?
And some kiddos spend more time in there than the regular classroom. It sort of all depends on what they can handle. And he has access to physical therapy, like fine motor type of work if he needed it. At this point, he's not utilizing that. And sometimes they come in the classroom, and sometimes he leaves the classroom to go complete his work with them. So we've been thrilled, absolutely thrilled with what Bedford's had to offer.
Great, great. So if you're willing, we of course have no idea what's on people's minds, but we do have a couple of people
okay.
If you wouldn't mind taking a couple of questions,
no.
A couple of topics, and then we'll get back a little bit. I want to talk a little bit more about the children and their responses to Jack. But first, we're going to go to area code 620. By the way, I identify you by area code. That's what I have up on my my producer board here. So we'll go first to area code 620 and then to area code 707. I think I probably know who these people are. Area code 620. You're on the Middle Ground. Welcome. What's your name and what would you like to talk about?
Hey, this is Jack Golding.
Hi,
can
Jack.
Hear me?
How are you?
Oh,
yes,
I can hear you. Jed or Jack?
Jack.
Name is Jack. You
okay.
Had a kid named Jack. Is that what you're talking about?
That's what they tell me.
Your kid was named Jack.
Yes.
So what's on your mind tonight?
Coincidence. Anyway, it's really not my forte, health problems, but this whole sequestration is affecting everybody. Because I just hear that that Obama wants to put $100 billion. Dollars on something to do with reconstruction.
Infrastructure work.
There's the bridges and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everything what the Republicans are doing is screwing, making matters tougher. For people like, Medicare is being cut and has not affected me yet. In a way, I'm a retired postal worker, and one of my priorities is try to fix the doggone. They're doing is unconstitutional anyway, because post office is one of the few places that's under the federal agency that's under the Constitution. So they provide post roads and all that other crap.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up sequestration, Jack, and thanks for the call, by the way. I tried to find today whether or not I tried to see whether or not, Carrie, there were any. I could get into the details of the sequestration, the $85 billion that's being cut, to see could I dig down enough to know whether something like, this money that Obama authorized in 2011, would it be reauthorized, or would there be cuts like that under sequestration? All we know, unfortunately, I was not able to dig that deeply, is that half of that money is definitely in social services. Do you worry, Carrie, in general, that the kinds of budget cuts that are being discussed could affect you and your family personally? I mean, is that something that that you think about? Should some of those services go away?
It certainly is always on the horizon. I mean, if the funding were cut in such that Jack could not have access to, say, an aid or a service at school that he really needs, or maybe, you know, he could only go once a week as opposed to twice a week. It's certainly something to consider, mm-hmm. and to keep an eye out for, sure.
And do you think about those services later on? I mean, you must have, I can't imagine you don't have some concerns about when Jack becomes a teenager, you know, or a young adult, or, you know, God forbid, at some point you and your husband are gone and Jack is an older adult. Do you think about the kind of services that, do you even know the kinds of services that you might need then? And
you
are
know,
those kinds of things generally available? Or?
We have talked about that quite a bit, about what the future holds for him, and, you know, how it's just so hard to say at this point, having an 8-year-old boy in front of you, what will he be like as a 28-year-old person? Will he be able to support himself? You know, everything we do each and every day supports that goal to keep him moving in the direction of independence, but there is certainly a chance that we won't reach it, and absolutely what the services will look like in the next 10 to 15 years are very important to us.
Right, I imagine it would be. Although I do remember from the book that Jack is, I don't know if he still is, but he was in love with somebody in his class, and they were planning on getting married and moving next door, right?
Yes, he's very in love with this girl. I'm not sure how reciprocated it is. I guess there was a little matter on the bus the other day. She warned him she would not be sitting with him on the bus that day. And he said she would never get Christmas presents again. So he doesn't like to be turned down. Yeah, so Jack does.
In that case,
see,
I think he's developing perfectly normal as a man.
Yes, he's right. He sees himself in a normal place in life, which is beautiful, but also I feel a fair amount of pressure hearing him articulate those goals, you know, what kind of car he's going to drive, what sort of house he wants to live in. He told me, I'm not going to know the names of his kids because he doesn't know them yet. So he's planning a future for himself,
right,
which I love, but it is a little bit of it's a little bit of push to me to commit to him every single day to help him reach those goals.
Right, understood. Let's go to our next caller, 707, and then we've got 602 in the call after that. Thanks again, Jack, for that call. Area code 707, welcome to the Middle Ground. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, my name's Linda, and I'm calling from Northern California.
Hello, Linda. Welcome to the Middle Ground. Thanks for joining us. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Well, my son, I live in California now, but my son went to school in New Hampshire. We lived in Wilton, and then after the divorce, we moved to Nashua.
Mm-hmm.
And my son is 30. He has Asperger's. High functioning, and he's going to be 31. Let's see, 80. Got to go back and think. 83. He was born, so yeah, that'd be. He's going to be 31.
Mm-hmm.
The difference, it sounds like, is they're identifying kids a lot sooner now.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the troubles we had, Chris being drug out of class by his arms, which he hates being touched.
Mm-hmm.
Screaming and, you know, kids touching him and the teacher not seeing it. And, you know, so he's like a caged lion. But he's like, the kids make a ring around him, you know.
Oh.
And he's just flailing away blindly. So there's some... It's good that they can catch him early so you can avoid a lot of that. He'll never go to college now. No, he's really into programming and stuff like that. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was going to... Does he currently take advantage of any public services?
When we moved out here, he was on disability. He got a girlfriend from online, an online text-based game, and she moved in with us, and then they moved to South Dakota. So he lives in the Midwest now, and he started off with some help from the Voc Rehab out there in by Mount Rushmore. And they helped him figure out what an interview would be like, you know, the kind of questions they would drill him on what might be asked and how you would be the best way to answer, and a hygiene question, because that's always an issue. And so his first job, I mean, well, anyway, he did the disability, he did the, what do they call it, work to, I forget what it's called, but it's like it diminishes until when you're working, you get Social Security up until, you know, and then as the years progress, it drops down, and it just totally dropped off. So he's working, he can't get full-time, but that's because of the economy, not because, you know, he can't do it. And he's got a job where he's actually doing something that's good for him, because it's not face-to-face with people. He always liked helping people, though. And so this is a call-in center for people with internet problems and things. So he can... his main problem is keeping the amount of time down. They want you to fix the problem in X amount of minutes. And, you know, I'm afraid I'm the same way. If the problem's not fixed, I'm going to keep on the call and get till it's fixed. And they know that, and they give him credit for that. And he actually got a little extra training on how to... when people have trouble with the hardware part of it, not just so much connecting to the internet, but if there's a hardware problem. So he got some extra training, and it's a big load off when you, because there's always that worry, you know, what if something happens to me? How's he going to manage? You know, how's he going to have a life? And it's a big load off to know that if anything does, then he'll be okay.
But I mean, he's out on his own, which sounds like a success story. I think certainly, Linda, you probably would get some credit for that. I mean,
Well, I don't know. I made so many mistakes. We didn't know what it was. But his relationship kind of went under. But if he has a job that he likes, and who knows what the future might hold? You know.
Yeah.
Well, I only had.
No, go ahead, Linda. I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
Well, I was just going to say, I only had the one, and when, I guess it was around, it was in the 90s, probably around 96 or so, I was talking to people on a Tourette's news group, because his diagnosis started with the speech problems. Well, every daycares were always terrible. Because I was in the service, so he had to be in daycare right away. They only give you 30 days. And my ex was going to college, so you know, he would always such a sweet boy, but he doesn't know how to change it from one activity to another without a big fight. You know, getting along with the other kids, and you never know what it is up until. Oh, I guess it was around 96 or 97, and I was he got the attention deficit label, and then he got without the hyperactivity, and then he got the Tourette's because the Ritalin bringing out the tics, and then he had the seizure disorder because he has temporal lobe epilepsy, or I guess it's called complex partial seizure disorder now. So it's always good to get a sleep-deprived EEG just to rule that out. And so we had taken him to Boston because we had insurance through Harvard Pilgrim, and we went to Children's Hospital and had special EEG called a beam study done. And so he was on Tegretol. And for the seizures. And anyway, what I was going to say is in this news group that I was on, and I was talking about some of my son's problems with hygiene and everything, somebody who was in California that was a special ed teacher or something, she said, you know, you might want to look into this thing that's just being talked about called Asperger's. And I'm going, okay, what is it, you know? And I started looking it up, and it's like, oh, my gosh, all the people fell into
Oh, wow.
I'm sure you know how that's feeling.
I do.
Yeah, it's very interesting, you know, the different stories we've heard along the way of people who go through the diagnostic sort of, you know, it's almost like a maze trying to get to the center where you can get the kind of diagnosis you want. First of all, Linda, thank you very much for calling and sharing your story. I'm encouraged, you know, the fact that your son has managed to get out on his own. That's great. It brings up a very interesting point we haven't talked about a great deal, and that is that the vast majority of attention and the vast majority of the support and services that are available specifically for autism are aimed at children. And very often what happens with adults is from a support and services point of view, they sort of, I'll use the word again, they sort of get mainstreamed into some of those traditional places, business rehabilitation and things of that nature. And there is significantly, I don't know the exact numbers, but there's significantly less funding oriented towards adults with autism or who are on the spectrum. And I think to your point earlier, Carrie, that is a concern. I can't imagine it would be one that would necessarily ever go away. I'm wondering, I know that Jack is pretty high functional, but as you mentioned before, you must think pretty regularly about what the future holds for him.
Absolutely. I absolutely do. And people caution us, you know, professionals caution us, try not to, don't get too wrapped up in that and just take it day by day. But, you know, as a parent, I think you worry about all of your children's futures. And when you have one who functions a little differently than everybody else, you just wonder how will he find his place in the world. We do take some solace in the fact that he will have siblings. I in no way expect any of his siblings to take care of him or to make sacrifices in their own lives, you know, on his behalf. But I do know he'll have that network around him should something happen to Joe or I. But it's a very scary consideration.
Very much so. We have one other caller, and then we'll start to wrap up here in a few minutes. Area code 620. We've been waiting for quite a while. Thank you very much for your patience. Area code 620. Let me bring you in.
Okay,
welcome to the Middle Ground. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
This is Jack Greenhagen again.
I'm sorry?
Yeah.
620?
Yeah, 620. I just wanted to say I remember now where Obama, I think it's related to what the caller has to say. He wants $100 billion, $100 million or $100 billion to do research on the brain, genome, and all that, all these illnesses may be related to the brain. So there's a relationship there.
You know, you bring up an excellent point, and I want to make this brief, Jack, because we do have another caller. I think we have one other caller in queue. One of the things that suffers very much in when budget battles occur, there's sort of two angles to this. One is that sort of scientific research, longer-term scientific research, that could really lead us to some answers. And I think research into genes, as Jack mentioned, is one of those. Certainly, there are probably a variety of components, but I'm going to give you a chance to comment on this a minute, Carrie, because I know this is something you've thought about. Obviously, when you look at the kinds of increases in autism over years, there have to be a number of factors. I mean, it's been very sudden, and genetics can't possibly be the whole answer, unless humankind has taken some sort of evolutionary leap that we're not aware of.
Right.
But you do talk a bit in your book about how, you know, it seems like everybody in your family has some qualities of this. and we do know from studies that if you have a child with autism, that you are, I forget what the number is, but significantly more likely, your any additional children you have have a significantly higher risk of also being on the spectrum. So we know there's a genetic component attached to it. But talk for a minute about why you feel like everybody's a little bit autistic.
Well,
if
basically,
that's not being too flippant.
myself included. I think it's I think it's more of a case of diagnostics. I think we're starting to look at it and diagnose, you know, sort of cast the net a little wider. I can think back, so I'm 38 years old, and I can think back to a first grade class and a little boy there who was clearly, now in retrospect, on the spectrum. He clearly had issues, and he raged and threw tantrums, and I have some really vivid memories of him struggling to stay within the classroom. And you know, to my knowledge, he wasn't diagnosed, and it wasn't really something we talked about then. So I think as years go on, we're just starting to recognize qualities in people that sort of inhibit their ability to socialize and to learn and to play. And we're kind of broadening the spectrum, if you will, and then more people fall on it, if that makes sense. So with that in mind, absolutely, I think we all have elements of spectrum disorder within ourselves, whether we're able to mitigate it so we can integrate well within our culture and our society, or it's something that doesn't really get in our way. You know, I myself, I'm very particular about my clothing, about the fabrics that I wear. I'm very particular about my workspace and how it's laid out. So I have some rigidity issues. It doesn't prohibit me from functioning the way some of Jack's issues prohibit him from getting through his day without assistance. But, yeah, I'm definitely very aware of it now, especially in my kids. They're all crazy.
Yeah, it is very interesting. When I read that portion of your book, I found myself thinking about, you know, various habits that I have. And, for example, I don't like being touched by people. Interestingly, I'm in a social circle with a lot of human resources professionals, and perhaps more than any other class of people, human resources professionals like to hug each other. I sort of have a reputation. My wife sometimes will warn people ahead of time, Michael is the guy who doesn't like to be hugged, so you know, just shake his hand when you meet him. So I think you're right, there is a little bit. And I also think you bring up an interesting point. I haven't looked into this much, but whether or not some of the increase in the number of diagnostic cases over the last 10 years, particularly the last 3 years, has to do with having widened that net. When I have 15 years on you, and when I was a teenager, I had a very good friend, Denise Pova, who worked with autistic children. She was a work study program, and she was 15, 16 years old, and she was working as an aide. And at that time, we thought of autistic children as children who were highly, highly unfunctional. These were kids who banged their heads on the wall, or they bit themselves, or if they could get a hold of a sharp object, they cut themselves.
Right.
But that was the picture we had. Somebody like Jack, as you described him, would not have been somebody when I was a kid that we would have thought of as being autistic. We would have thought of him as being kind of weird, and he might have gotten bullied a bit.
Maybe not have been very successful in school, and maybe have dropped out of school, or been, you know, we had a special education room, a whole room that they just went to, and who knows what happened when you got hauled down to that room, and there were, you know, everybody rode the short bus when you kind of fell under that. And then over the years, it changed to Rain Man. And Rain Man sort of became our poster child or poster face for what autism looked like. And I enjoyed that movie. I still could watch it now and enjoy it. But the face is changing. And, you know, there's elements of all of our faces in autism. And I think that that's the message I hope the book brings to light, that there are different faces to autism than the stereotypes we're used to.
Great. So, on that note, I want to just kind of end. We talked a little bit about the relationship between the kids and each other, and the book is very touching on that point. In fact, you know, for those of you interested, I do urge you to pick up a copy. Again, full transparency, I'm the publisher, so I certainly want the book sold as well. But it really is a wonderful read. If you know anyone on who's been touched by autism, the reviews on the book have been excellent. And also, again, there's a donation, or a piece of it is being donated to Autism Speaks, which is one of several organizations, I promised I would come back to this topic, who are working very hard on a regular basis to promote autism awareness and to encourage donations for further research. there are much of the research and development and the impetus for investigation into autism spectrum disorder is coming from the private sector, which I frankly think is a wonderful thing, particularly as a moderate to conservative. I feel very strongly that the private sector is the place for a lot of this to happen. Notwithstanding the kinds of services individual people need, but the charitable contribution portions for particularly these kinds of public health issues that tend to be a little bit more under the radar than, as I say, some of those crisis issues that make it onto the news. Private charity is a very, very big component of all of this. Another one that I want to mention is the Doug Flutie Foundation. Doug Flutie was nice enough to do a review of the book for us. And Doug Flutie Jr. has autism, and Doug Flutie, who, for those of you who don't know, was for many years a quarterback at New England Patriots, started a foundation, the Doug Flutie Jr. Foundation for Autism, which is another very worthwhile organization worth talking to. You mentioned earlier, Carrie, the fact that Joey and now Charlie. Mm-hmm. Who are just one older and one younger than Jack, are both now have the name autism to attach to Jack and have asked you questions about that. One of the things in the book, and I'm going to ask you to read this section because I think it's really wonderful. Joey at one point asked Carrie, well, I'll let you tell the story, but Joey actually has a chapter in the book.
Yes, he
Joey, by the way, Joey's just 10 years old. So at the time that this was being written, we're talking about a 9-year-old who's coming to his mother about this topic. Go ahead.
Right. Just 9. So it was about a year ago, so he was just 9. So he understood I was writing the book, and he had known for quite some time about Jack. And so at one point he wandered up to me. Again, I was in the kitchen. I spent an exorbitant amount of time in the kitchen. So he said, while I was preparing a meal, I would like to write a chapter for that book. I have some things to say. You know, I have some things to say about what it's like to be Jack's brother. I thought, well, that's really interesting. And I encouraged him to do that. And we kind of put it by, on our to-do list. And then one night after all the other kids were in bed, he came back downstairs and he said, I'm ready to write my chapter now. And he sat at my computer, and without really any guidance from me, I kind of left the room, he wrote this chapter. So it's sort of a letter from Joey about, and he titled it all on his own, Autistic Brothering by Joey Cariello. As Jack's bigger brother, I have a lot of responsibilities. One of my natural responsibilities is to try and keep him calm. My parents don't ask me to do this. I do it because I'm his brother. But it's not like he needs any help with video games. And to my surprise, he seems excellent at them. Take the game he plays, Fast Draw Showdown, as an example. The idea is to shoot the other person before they shoot you when the bottom of the screen says draw. He plays other games occasionally. It feels like I have a successor. I'm a video game geek big time. Also, he loves the Wii. Though he never plays the computer, Jack is fond of video games. Sometimes I feel embarrassed if a fourth grader asks about Jack and if he has autism. Sometimes I think about what life would be if Jack didn't have autism. I think it would be a little bit strange because our family would seem to be perfect. Life can be hard for Jack. That's why I don't respect anyone who doesn't respect my brothers or my sister. I sometimes get the feeling that I leave Jack out a lot, and I'm being a bad brother. I feel like I spend too much time with my other siblings, so I try to spend more time with him and play the things he likes. I try to be the best brother I can. I like him just the way he is, even though he has autism. The end.
And on that note, I think we'll wrap for tonight. That letter always gets me.
I know.
Thinking about a 9-year-old being that aware
and
that sensitive to what's going on around him. So I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. Again, today is World Autism Awareness Day as a kickoff to Autism Awareness Month. And hopefully we brought a personal touch to the show tonight with guest Carrie Cariello. Again, the kinds of services, the kinds of funding, the kinds of public support necessary for people not only with autism, but across the autism spectrum and with a host of other needs are it's a pressing and growing concern in our country. We've talked on the show a number of times that we believe a transpartisan issue is having an appropriate social safety net for everyone in this country, and myself and others in the Coffee Party often differ and squabble about how best to implement that safety net, but there's no question that issues like this, particularly ones that, that don't necessarily always get the attention that they deserve, and in which affect millions of people in this country. We're not just talking about the people who are on the spectrum, but we're talking about their families, their brothers, their sisters, their parents, their cousins, their teachers, the neighborhoods that they live in, the bus drivers who drive them back and forth to school. Autism awareness is a very important issue. I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to thank you, Carrie, for joining me on short notice.
Thank you.
I always love hearing you read. I think you do a wonderful job in telling this story, and hopefully our audience will agree. Again, the name of the book, What Color is Monday? How Autism Changed One Family for the Better, by author Carrie Cariello from New Hampshire. Thank you, Carrie, very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, and good night from the Middle Ground. We'll see you again next week.
That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow the Middle Ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on The Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong, and be heard.